Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 60 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the non-fiction writer and novelist Alex Martin speaks with Carol Angier about his early writing career as he moves from children's writing through English language textbooks to the whimsical delights of decadence.
Alex Martin was born in the USA in 1953 of a Greek mother and an English father. He grew up in Kent and was educated at Winchester and Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, where he took a BA in English in 1975. He spent 20 years as a teacher at Sevenoaks School, Verona University, the Crown and Manor Boys Club in Hoxton, and at numerous British Council seminars in Germany and Eastern Europe. In the 1990s, he presented radio programmes for the BBC World Service and began writing full-time. He's married with two sons. He has published 28 books, including textbooks on literature and culture, fiction for adults and children, and several historical works, including studies of daily life in Roman and medieval times. In 2008, he was commissioned to write the history of the Air Squadron. He recorded some 50 interviews with pilots, military and civilian, in the course of this project. From 2009 to 2012, he lived in Athens, observing the economic crisis, travelling in Greece, exploring his family history, and writing. He distilled his experiences in a crime novel, codenamed Xenophon, published under the pseudonym Leo Canaris in 2014. He is currently writing the 200th anniversary history of the Royal Yacht Squadron. Although this is an official history with its due record of yachts, regattas, and public events, he also sees it as a human story, and gives particular importance to the lives and experiences of its members. Alex, you've published 28 books in many different genres. I haven't even managed to trace all of them. But, unless I've missed some, you started in the 1980s. I think with two children's books.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have two sons. Was it they who started you writing, and did you have any idea of the career that you were embarking on?
Actually, it wasn't my sons who started me writing. I'd been doing that already. I wrote my first children's book, actually inspired by the drought of 1976. I'd been a school teacher. I'd taught children aged 11 upwards, and so I'd read quite a lot of children's literature, and I was very, you know, taken with it. And during the drought of 1976, when England suddenly became like the Mediterranean, all the fields turned brown and so on, it was an extraordinary summer. I had to look after my parents' garden while they went off on their summer holiday, and particularly look after a greenhouse full of tomatoes. And I used to go down there in the evenings and water the tomatoes, and sometimes I left it till after dark. And I remember one night just the tomato leaves, which are great hairy things, brushing my face and thinking, my God, this is rather sinister. And it was a sort of Day of the Triffids moment. And I suddenly thought, gosh, what if a tomato wanted to strangle me and then go on and take over the world? And that was the beginning of my first book, Boris the Tomato. So it was quite independent of having children.
Well, now, as you say, Boris the Tomato, your first children's book, is about a power-hungry tomato, and he's a vegetable Hitler, I think, isn't he?
Yeah.
And this little book for children has all the excitement of a war story, but at the same time, it has a pretty strong, in a way, anti-war message, because Boris is soundly defeated at the end. And then, 10 years later, you recalled Boris from the dead, as, you know, Conan Doyle did with Sherlock Holmes, and wrote Boris the Return, which I have not found. Now, I want to know whether this one's got a moral message, in a way, gentle one, hidden in the adventure as well, and whether you think that children's books should really have a moral somewhere as well as fun.
Yeah, it does. The second one is, it's really, I mean, Boris the Return, it's the son of Boris. it begins inside the guts of a blackbird. and the blackbird is flying over England, and it does what all things do. It unleashes the remains from its back end, and the seeds fall out, and they fall into a sort of genetic research institute, and there a kind of super tomato is being developed by a very sinister character who is trying to create things like strawberries with armoured skin, you know, that can be transported easily and so on. I mean, basically it was a sort of parody of the whole world of genetic modification. And he creates these terrible monsters, you know, who again go out on a form of vegetable Armageddon. So there is a moral there of, you know, don't mess with nature, basically. Rather simplistic. Should children's stories always have a moral? Well, I'm not so sure. I think the great Roald Dahl's children's books they're sort of anti-moral in a way, except that they're on the side of the good. You know, they're against moralising people. But I think it's very difficult to write at all without being on the side of the good, actually. So whether it's children's stories or anybody's stories, I think morals come in. Inevitably. But I think often the morality in a book is not necessarily in the great outlines of the thing. It's often in very simple moments, delicate moments. I mean, that's the only sense in which morality works. It's very difficult to make moral rules that are universally applicable.
Well, your other children's, as it were, series, well, anyway, pair of books, features a boy hero called Zeus Perkins. And again, I only found the first one, which is called Zeus Perkins and the Exploding Planet. And this is a hilarious tale of a gang of 11-year-olds obsessed with science and showing grown-ups that kids can manage things a lot better than they can. It also has a subplot about an evil villain who wants to rule the world, so we've got Boris the Tomato again, in a way, and lots of jokes, such as, for example, adverts for the gang's inventions, which cost millions of pounds on the open market, but £39.99 to kids. So this book feels to me very much in an English tradition of comedy for and about children, like Molesworth, for example, and the St. Trinian's books, and also in an English tradition of comedy altogether, so Monty Python in particular, and maybe Private Eye. So I wonder whether this is true. Do you think it is in a tradition like that? And were you aware of it when wrote it?
Yeah, of course I was, yes. I mean, I've always loved comedy, and my first agent said to me, you should write comic fiction, you know, you can do this. It's just, I mean, that was based on Boris the Tomato, really. He said, not many people can. And I should undoubtedly have followed his advice instead of going running off writing historical things. But was I aware of it? Well, I had worked with one of the Monty Pythons, Graham Chapman, just after I finished university. I helped him write his autobiography, A Liar's Autobiography. I met all the other Monty Pythons. I watched all the Monty Python stuff and was aware of, you know, their traditions going back to the Goons and so on. I mean, I think they're some of the highest achievements of our very high-achieving race. You know, and humour is so much part of the English genius. Not only the actual products of the humour, like all the great radio and television comedy and the great comic novels of Dickens and so on, but also the humour in the everyday approach to life, which, going back to morality, it seems to me is an enormous moral advantage. People who can laugh at themselves, who can laugh at the comedy of life, not take things too seriously. It's a positive good, that really is.
Moving on then to your first adult novel, The General Interrupter, which was published in 1989 and won the Betty Trask First Novel Award. It's a comic novel, very funny, very skillful, young man's novel. Its hero, Paul Smith, is bored with life in England and he takes off to Italy. Now, this seems to me to be a sort of classic English love affair with Italy novel, a bit like E.M. Forster. So, what I want to ask is that you lived in Italy yourself for 5 years, but unlike Paul, you did come back in the end. So why, and more importantly, why did you make your fictional hero choose Italy?
Well, one of the great things about writing fiction is you can do things in a story which you can't do in real life. I don't know why I found it difficult to go back to Italy. I loved it. I loved being there, and my wife loved being there as well. And, in fact, I put at the start of The General Interrupter a little proverb in Latin, actually, which was quoted to me quite a lot when I was in Italy. Ubi bene, ibi patria. Where you are well, that is your homeland. And I felt Italy is my home, my spiritual home. In a sense, I still do. Every time I go back there, I feel totally comfortable. I love the language. It's an easy language. It trips like music off the tongue. The food's wonderful, and so on and so forth. Why didn't I go back? I just don't know. I do know. I wanted to have a literary career. I felt I needed to know publishers, I needed to know journalists, I needed to know other writers. Out in Italy, I was teaching very nice people in the marble industry, doctors, chemists, engineers, really good professional types, but they weren't writers. I didn't know writers, and I felt a yearning to be among artists and talking about artistic things. And I knew how to do that in England. I didn't know how to get in touch with those people in Italy, really. So it was a professional decision. But my wife has never really allowed me to forget it. She said, "Why did we leave? It was so wonderful."
Okay, the other side of the coin, of course, in The General Interrupter is England and the terrifically dismal picture that you paint of it. A Puritan land of miserable, inhibited people who can only relax when they're smashed out of their minds. Now, of course, this is a comic novel and the whole point is exaggeration, to make us laugh. But laugh with recognition, as we do. So you are only half English, as we know, and half Greek. And you've lived in Greece for 3 years as well as 5 years in Italy. Do you feel, to some extent, an outsider who can look at your home from a different angle than most purely English writers?
Yes, of course. And that's been the case since I was a child. I mean, when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s in England, there was still very much the assumption around that English was best and foreigners were dirty and beneath us and so on. So there was a slight feeling of being an outsider and an inferior outsider at that. So one had to sort of very much stake one's claim and be kind of twice as good at anything as English people were in order to get respect. So I did always feel an outsider, and it went down to things like food. My mum was Greek and cooked the most wonderful Greek food, and I'd go to my friends' houses and have strange things to me, like kidneys, which I found absolutely inedible, and odd things out of packets and tins that were really, really dreary. I mean, the worst kind of English cooking was very like school food. It was very dreary. So this terrible dichotomy grew up in my mind, which I think is actually false, but it did grow up in my mind, that there was England, a land of sensory deprivation, grim food, people working terribly hard, always putting off pleasure today for the sake of pleasure in the future, and so on. I really do think that's complete nonsense now, but I mean, that's the way I grew up, and I was writing very much in that vein there. Now I've got a much more rounded and accepting view of it. I think of myself as a mixed culture person. There are millions of people of mixed culture all over the world. The English themselves are a mixed culture race. It's part of our enormous strength as a culture that we've allowed many other cultures to come in and influence us, and it always enriches us. So I don't now feel as divided as I used to. I just feel like a European, a human being,
Okay, shall we move on from The General Interrupter? So we're now into the 1990s. And you begin writing full-time. So you wrote several more Boris's and Zeus Perkinson's, which we've mentioned, and you wrote a lot of textbooks, and you wrote your first three decadents. Now, to start with the textbooks, I mean, I presume these came out of your teaching?
Yes, they did, yes. I was teaching at Verona University, and I got very interested in teaching techniques, actually, largely because I'd done a course in teaching English as a foreign language, where the essence of it really was that you would, as a teacher, you would give your students a new phrase to learn, or a verb form or something like, I went to the cinema last week, not I have gone to the cinema last week. You're trying to teach them the difference between the past simple and the present perfect. Now, if you just explain it to a student, they'll take it in or not. But if you then drill it, you give lots and lots of exercises where they practice it, and then you give them free practice, they're much more likely to remember it. So I used to do that, and then I tried applying that sort of thing to literature. The way literature was taught at the university tended to be professor or lecturer talking for 45 minutes, setting out their theories of the book. Students write notes, go home, and that's that. I tried to make the literature classes much more interactive. I mean, in the simplest possible way, we did a course on Shakespeare, and I got the students actually performing the Shakespeare, trying to stage bits of it, which you immediately discover elements in the text, because Shakespeare was a great dramatic writer, that there are actions in the text which you do not see when you read it on the page. You have to actually try and walk it on the stage, and then you realise there's all sorts of hidden depths in the text. So I did a lot of that sort of thing, and also I decided that with technical terms like metaphor and simile, just a few things like that, which I think are essential tools for understanding literature, verse forms and so on, I would give the students practice in using those too. So I devised exercises for that, and the students were in the end very, very grateful to me, actually, and many of them went on to become teachers themselves. I wasn't alone in doing this. It was with my colleagues. We all decided we were going to do it. It was a little kind of revolution that we were running there, and it really was. It was exhilarating. It was very, very good, and I wanted to try and put some of that into a book. So with one of my colleagues, Rob Hill, we proposed doing an anthology of 20th century literature, which Cassell took on, four volumes, one on short stories, one on poetry, one on novels, and one on plays.
Yeah.
And we would give extracts from novels and plays, whole poems, whole short stories. And there were lots of exercises then, classroom exercises, discussion exercises, writing exercises and so on, looking at both the language and the literary techniques, which would demystify the language of literary criticism, give the students a chance to try out the tools of literary criticism and textual analysis, and thereby be empowered. And I really enjoyed writing those books too. It seemed to be a useful thing to do, and it also taught me a great deal about writing. And you look underneath the car, as it were, and you see how it works and open everything out. You learn a lot about how good sentences are put together and so on.
And there wasn't there a man, I think he was called Robin Ryecroft, is that right, who made an absolute fortune writing English textbooks for schools?
I mean, there are lots of people who've become millionaires through that.
Yeah,
actually.
Many, I
yes,
see.
Yes.
I see, perhaps I just heard of him. And so I wonder whether, you know, could I ask this, how did your textbooks do? And do you recommend textbook writing as a way for writers to make a steady bottom line of income?
Well, it used to be like that, you know, that you'd sort of come out of the whatever your regiment was in the war and, you know, take up a bit of teaching and then write a book and it would become a bestseller. But actually the market is very saturated now. It was already getting saturated when I started. And the way to make money then was to write a course book for students of English abroad. But even that is heavily saturated now. So I'm not sure if it is a good way to make a living. It's also very, very time-consuming. I mean, writing a good textbook, you have to try out all the exercises yourself. You've got to try them on other people. It all takes time. You've got to write incredibly clear instructions and so on. How did they do? It's funny. When we started, I approached lovely man at Kassel called Simon Nugent. He was our editor. And I remember walking into his office and saying, I've got to do an anthology for you, you know. And he said, oh, why? And I explained, and there's nothing like this on the market. And he said, well, what titles would you do? And I said, short stories, poems. And he said, well, short stories will sell, because they always do. And I said, well, why won't poems sell? He said, they won't sell. They won't sell nearly as well. So I said, OK, well, I don't know how you can predict that. And he said, short stories always sell well. Anyway, 15 years later, I can tell you that Simon Nugent was absolutely right. I mean, that one sold, I don't know, 30,000 copies, and poetry sold 4,000 copies. He was dead right, you know.
That's very interesting, yeah. Though, because, I mean, one has, you know, the orthodox idea is that actually books of short stories don't sell terribly well. So well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, well, he was an ELT publisher, English language teaching publisher, and he knew that anthologies of short stories sell in that sector, and they do. I don't know what to say to your question about how to make a bottom line living while you're writing. It's terribly, terribly difficult. Probably, I would say, go and work in the financial services industry and make as much money as you can until you're 30, and then go off and live somewhere very cheap and write novels. But it might not work.
Okay, now for something completely different, as Monty Python used to say. And that is the other series of books that you began in the 1990s. So if your textbooks were your daylight, sort of father of the family side, this was very much a nighttime, à rebours side. So now your co-writer on these books, your decadent books, calls them, quote, your triptych of perversion, which is by now, I think, a quintiptych, if there's such a word, since you've added two more in the 2000s. Mm. So the whole series are now called the Decadent Cookbook, the Decadent Gardener, the Decadent Traveller, plus the Decadent Sportsman and the Hellfire Touring Club, which were written in the 2000s. Are you having fun writing these books? And is that really the point of them?
Yes, it is the point. We did it, the first one, completely as a joke, really. And I remember a friend of mine, who's a very good writer, read The Decadent Cookbook, and he said, you know, this is actually a very good book. And I said, no, well, no, it's not. It's a squib. It's a laugh. At this. And he said, yeah, I know you say that, but actually it is a very good book. I was very surprised by that. And but I think it is now, actually. It seems to me very amusing. I mean, I regard that as, you know, if you can amuse somebody, that's a great thing to do in this veil of tears. But I must say, decadence is a very interesting research tool in itself. One of the problems about researching anything is that the available material for most subjects is overwhelmingly huge, and you have to decide at some point where you're going to stop. With decadence, it's quite easy because you just go for the most extreme examples of what you're writing about. With decadent cooking, for instance, when we started, I remember thinking that a vodka sorbet was a very decadent thing, or lobster-filled ravioli. Then when I started looking at the history of gastronomy, and this is actually a history of extreme cooking, I discovered that people were doing far more exciting things than filling ravioli with lobsters. I mean, my favourite recipe in the whole thing was peacock, served in its plumage with live birds inside it. And indeed, there is a recipe in a 16th century Italian cookbook that explains how to do that. You know, that sort of thing, that sort of extreme, using artifice and so on. I found it all rather aesthetically pleasing, as well as very amusing. And also looking at conventional morality. I mean, my co-writer, Jerome Fletcher, who poses as Dorian Gray, is a really free-thinking guy. I mean, he really relishes turning conventional morality upside down. And it's very interesting to see what happens when you do that, at least in your mind. I don't actually believe in doing it in real life. We tried it a few times, but it was... So there are moments when you come up against reality, but in the safety of research and the Bodleian Library and so on, we had a lot of fun.
That was Alex Martin in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Alex on the RLF website, and you can hear the second part of this interview in episode 64. And that concludes episode 60, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 61, the novelist Jill Dawson tells Frances Burns about her writing's physicality and the surprising richness of The Fens. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.